I'm Marty Moskowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Reginald Duane Betts wrote a revealing essay in the New York Times last year titled, "Could an Ex-Con Become an Attorney I Intended to Find Out?" He wrote about being involved in a car hijacking at the age of 16, spending 9 years in adult prison, including many months in solitary confinement. He also wrote about discovering poetry in prison and how it changed him. The rest of the essay described how difficult reentry and getting a second chance have been when his record followed him everywhere, trying to get a job, his worries about what to tell his sons about his past, and after graduating from Yale Law School, the hurdles getting approved by the Connecticut Bar Association, which he finally did. Reginald Duane Betts explores some of this same territory in his new book of poems. It's called Felon. They are beautiful and brutal and brutally honest about incarceration and its aftermath and how he is haunted by what he did as a teenager. Reginald Duane Betts joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and it's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
And thank you for writing these poems.
Oh, thanks.
Which we will talk about. Let's begin with the first one in your book. It's called Ghazal. And perhaps you could tell us first what the title means.
Yeah, this is actually kind of interesting to do on radio because the listeners only get a chance to hear it. And the form is a Persian form, and it's a Persian Indian form, and it's sort of typically sung. And so it has a refrain that repeats. And so all the listeners, you'll hear a phrase that repeats again and again. That phrase is after prison. The poem is written in couplets, and you know a couplet has ended when you hear the words after prison. And the word before after prison always rhymes. So you'll hear expect, suspect, dialect. And then the other point about the poem is that it is not a narrative. It's a way to capture a bunch of narratives in one poem. It's not linear. Each couplet is almost its own thing. It's like a string of pearls. You know, each pearl is its own thing.
Yep.
So, Ghazal. Oh, the other point is that you sign your name in the last couplet, and that's sort of how you would know that the song is over and that the person is done. And while I was in prison, everybody called me Shahid because I named myself Shahid, and I did that because the word Shahid means the witness, and I sort of felt like I had no idea.
I just scribbled that down, yeah.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing in prison. I knew why I was in prison, but I needed to have meaning for my experience, and telling myself that I was a witness allowed me to have some kind of agency in what I was experiencing and witnessing. Ghazal. Name a song that tells a man what to expect after prison. Explains Occam's razor, you're still a suspect after prison. Titus Kaphar painted my portrait, then dipped it in black tar. He knows redaction is a dialect after prison. From inside a cell, the night sky isn't the measure. That's why it's prison's vastness your eyes reflect after prison. My lover, she don't believe in my sadness. She says whiskey, not time, is what left me wrecked after prison. Ruth, paper maker, take these tattered gray sweats. Make paper of my bed, a past I won't reject after prison. The state murdered Khalif with a single high bail. Always innocent. Did he fear time's effect after prison? Dear warden, my time been served, let me go. Promise that some of this I won't recollect after prison. My mother has died. My father, a brother, and two cousins. There is no God. No reason to genuflect after prison. Jeremy and Forrest rejected the template, said for it to be funky, the font must redact after prison. He came home saying righteous, coochie, and jive turkey. All them lost years, his slang's architect after prison. The printer silk screens a world on a black paper. With ink, Eric reveals what we neglect after prison. My homeboy says he's done with those circling cells. His wife and baby girl gave him love to protect after prison. Them fools say you can become anything when it's over. Told him straight up, ain't nothing to resurrect after prison. You have come so far, beloved, and for what? Another song? Then sing. Shahid, you're loved. Not shipwrecked after prison.
Thank you for reading that. And again, that's our guest, Reginald Dwayne Betts, reading the very beginning poem from his new collection of poetry, and it's called Felon. There's so much to talk about, but I kept coming back to the very last line. Then sing, Shahid, you're loved, not shipwrecked after prison. Because I always think poetry is so autobiographical. Did you feel loved after prison?
Oh, well, yeah. And maybe we should just talk about that first, too.
Sure.
I think, so poetry, particularly my poetry, is like both autobiographical and not. It is like my life is part of the data that I use to create the worlds that I want to create in verse. But if I only talked about my life, then there's a way in which there's so many things that I think we have to have conversations about. Especially if you care about decreasing the population in prison, you have to talk about domestic violence. You have to talk about violence. You have to talk about assault. You have to, like, talk about depression, alcoholism. And some of those things I've experienced, but a lot of them I haven't. And when we're talking about the post-incarceration experience, you know, I've had, like, a lot of tremendous success in my life. But if I really want to dig deep and really get at what it means to really go through this, some of the things I have to recount can't just be my story. But if I always say he or she or Joe or Bobby or Sam or anything like that, then what I'm doing is I'm distancing myself from the trauma in a way that in this particular book I was afraid to do, because I'm already far too often thought of as like exceptional or as an anomaly. But then there are these moments that are autobiographical. And so, like, this poem, when it says Shahid, I mean, that is autobiographical.
Sure.
But I was loved. I mean, I've been loved. I was loved in prison. You know, the reality is that, like, yeah, people have always cared deeply about me. And I'm fortunate beyond measure for friends. Sometimes for people who were just acquaintances that just for a second just deeply cared about me in that moment and made sure that I went the right direction instead of the wrong direction. But what's interesting about this, though, is that if you spend time in prison, you feel split between two worlds. A friend of mine keeps telling me that I'm suffering from survivor's guilt, except one of the challenges is that, like, we all survived, you know, and so the thing is my mind is split because you imagine that prison is an island. And when I say, you know, you're loved, not shipwrecked, but the idea is that I'm not shipwrecked. I'm shipwrecked here in what people imagine is the free world. Whereas I've recognized that maybe part of what I need to be doing is not returning to prison, but sort of returning to prison and peering people back.
Yeah.
And so that last couple is trying to capture this thing that, you know, somebody is telling me that I'm loved, and I think I am, and I'm telling myself that. But there's also this notion of what it means to not be able to return on that voyage that you started so long ago.
There's a poem you have behind the yellow tape where you write, we're all standing on the wrong side of choices.
Yeah.
And I underscored that because I think it's true. It is true for all of us. And I think in many ways, some of us are lucky that we didn't end up in prison like you.
Yeah. And, you know, and also, though, just like when I was saying that we're all on the wrong side of choices, I think it's very easy to kind of distinguish the life of a person who hasn't been in prison from the life of a person who has, just by that idea of prison, not acknowledging that, you know, we are all on the wrong side of choices. And in fact, there's many people who've never been locked up who have made just as serious and horrendous and disastrous choices as the ones that landed me in prison and that landed many folks in prison.
Your book is titled Felon, and I, again, words matter so much in poetry, but I kept coming back to that. And in one of the, maybe it was the New York Times article that you wrote, that it once meant vile or wicked. But I wonder, what do you think that means today, the word felon?
It still means,
I mean, it doesn't mean the same thing
it
that
still
it always
means,
has.
Yeah, I mean, it still means vile or wicked. It depends on who you talk to. And I think it means vile or wicked so much so that there are a number of people who have served time in prison or have criminal convictions that have decided they don't want to be referred to as an ex-convict, a convict, an inmate, a prisoner. They want to be referred to as a formerly incarcerated person, as a returning citizen. You know, what you name a thing matters.
Sure.
My thing is, I'm trying to get at the underside of why we call a person a felon. And I don't necessarily think calling me a formerly incarcerated person changes the way you think about me when you find out I carjacked somebody. I think that a lot of folks are just trying to be generous by changing the thing they call me, but they don't change the way they treat me. And so I wanted to write a book that tried to capture what it means for, like, these lives within the book to have experienced prison. But I hope that people read it and see reflections of themselves, though. They don't just see, like, oh, yeah, that's what a prisoner looks like. I hope they read it and see, oh, that's kind of what I look like.
Well, I noticed in a number of the descriptions about you, it generally said things like ex-con or, you know, not the more, shall we say, politically correct description of you, but more the ex-con. And do you own that?
Do I own it? I didn't make any of those decisions.
No, I understand.
Like all of
but
those
it follows
decisions.
You the way, yeah. You know, your record follows
well,
you.
Well, I guess I did make the decision to call this book Felon. But
you
I think,
did.
Yeah. And I think a lot of those decisions were made, I think, significantly and importantly made because, one, you call it an ex-con wanting to be a lawyer, it grabs people's attention. And it grabs people's attention because of the stigma that we attach to the phrase ex-con. Mm-hmm. But two, I think it's like, when I say I own it, I mean I got a lot of friends in prison who have committed violent crimes who should be free. And if I keep trying to find ways for you not to imagine however you think about them when you think about me, then I'm creating more distance. At least, you know, that's how I look at it. I don't want to create that kind of distance. I want people to think about me, think about the things I've done, and recognize that there's so many people in prison who could approximate some of this living, who actually could fully embody this living. When you recognize that, you know, who I am as a basketball coach. You know, I coach my kids' basketball team. You know, who I am is like a father. Who I am is a friend. You know, I think that try to be many things and people come home and they could be many things. And, you know, can't imagine we could be any of those things if you think that what it means to be an ex-con is to be wielding a knife.
Well, I think we have, these vivid ideas about what an ex-con is. What do you think our images of being a poet is? Do we even think about that?
Yeah, I don't know if we have as vivid ideas of what
a
it means
to be a
poet.
A kind of invisible person?
Yeah, you know, I think the poet in our society is neither threatening nor threatened. You know, I think that I know some fabulous poets. I know some wonderful poets who have profoundly changed my life, who have profoundly changed the lives of people who read that work. But I think that we are still trying to get to the point where, you know, you don't hear poets commenting on the presidential election. You know,
you don't hear poets at all.
Right. I mean, you're not, you know, you're thinking about people who spend so much time contemplating what it means to be alive in the world. You're thinking about writers who study, research, contemplate, and then write provocative books about things like mass incarceration. And, you know, you don't hear, I know a lot of people who write novelists, poets, who have experienced prison just because this is what we're talking about. And I can't name a single presidential candidate. I can't name a single member of the House or the Senate. I can't name state representatives who said, you know, you an expert. Let me consult you on what these things mean.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Reginald Dwayne Betts. He's a poet. He's a lawyer joining us on Radio Time to talk about his new collection of poetry and to read some more as well. The book is called Felon. Call us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Reginald Dwayne Betts. He's the author of a memoir, came out a few years ago, called A Question of Freedom, a memoir of learning, survival, and coming of age in prison. He was 16 years old when he and some friends carjacked a car, spent just about 9 years in adult prison. He's also written 3 books of poetry, including a new one called Felon. And again, joining us on Radio Times to talk a bit about his life, to talk about incarceration, to talk about poetry as well. I'd love to have you read this this poem called Essay on Reentry for Nicholas Davidoff.
Essay on Reentry. Of prison, no one tells you the time will steal your memories until there's nothing left but strip searches and a hole and fights and hidden shanks and the spades games. You come home and become a parade of confessions that leave you drowning. Laws recounting the disappeared years. You say forget this world with background checks like your fingerprints announce the crime. Where so much of who you are betrays guilt older than you. Your pops, uncles, a brother, 2 cousins, and enough childhood friends for a game of throwback. All learned absurdity from shackles. But we wear the mask that grins and lies. Why pretend these words don't seize our breath? Prisoner, inmate, felon, convict. Nothing can be denied. Not the gun that delivered you to that place where you witnessed the images that won't let you go. Catfish learning to subtract, his eyes a heron slurred mess. Blue-black doing backflips in state boots. The D.C. kid that killed the cellmate. Jesus. Barely older than you, he had on one of the white undershirts made by other men in prison. Boxers, socks that slouch, shackles gripping his shins. Nearly naked. Life waiting. Outside your cell, you could see them wheel the dead man down the way. The pistol you pressed against the stranger's temple gave you that early morning. And now, boxes checked have become your North Star, Philip, catalyst to despair. Death by prison stretch. Tell me, what name for this thing that haunts, this thing we become?
Such a powerful poem. Again, it's called Essay on Reentry for Nicholas Davidoff. And again, read by our guest, Reginald Dwayne Betts. I did look up Nicholas Davidoff because I didn't know who he was. Why is this dedicated to him?
He's a friend of mine. I think, you know, we moved to New Haven, me and my wife and my two sons, our two sons. We moved to New Haven because I was going to Yale Law School. And it's kind of interesting because you move to a city for a really specific purpose. And then you find a community and you find a group of friends. And this poem is dedicated to Nicky because he had read an early draft and we were talking about it. And we were talking about the ways in which some of the things that I'm writing about is intersected with some of the things that he's written about. But just what it means to be a part of a community. And I'm sending a signal, too, you know, because I feel like living in New Haven, you know, you imagine that crime and incarceration and all of these things that I write about only affect people who are black or Latino, you know, largely people of color. But the reality is that, like, it's a problem that affects everybody. And I dedicated it to him because he sort of recognizes that it's a problem that affects everybody.
You carjacked a guy who was sitting in his car, you know, with some friends in a parking lot. You make numerous references to what happened that day, and including in an essay also called Essay on Reentry, where you imagine perhaps it was a kiss and not a gun.
Yeah.
And what that might have meant or been.
Yeah, I think there, you know, it's a kind of intimacy that is involved with crime and with violence. And you become irrevocably connected to the life of somebody you harmed. And so for me, turning it that way forced me to really contemplate just how much of this man's space I invaded. Yeah. And you know, what's interesting in that poem, too, is the guy's like, you know, I was robbed there, but the food was good, and I might return. And the speaker's like, he's telling me he was robbed there like he don't know that I did it. And I think the subtext of that poem is that these two men are talking and they have a relationship that happened after the crime got committed. And what I like about that is what I'm trying to suggest is that if we will ever get to a point where we move past this state of mass incarceration, it's going to require people who have committed crimes to be in communion with people who have been victims of crimes. And the reality is that we are already in communion in that way, you know.
You end by saying, say the gun was a kiss against the sleeping man's forehead. Say that you might have been his lover and that on a different night he might have moaned. And I just circled and underscored all that because I just thought it was just so profound in so many ways.
Thank you. And troubling.
And troubling. Deeply troubling.
But such is life.
Yeah.
Deeply troubling.
Yeah. In that New York Times article I referenced, and you did this in your memoir, and it shows up in a lot of these poems here. You talk about your trial and the fact that you confessed and had to speak to the court. You said, I'm not here because my dad wasn't in my life. It's not my mother's fault.
I was young, too. I was like, I'm really proud. I mean, you know.
You were 16, 17 years old?
I was 16.
16 years old.
I was 5'5", 125 pounds.
Yeah.
Had never been away from home for more than a week, and suddenly I'm locked up, and I've been locked up at that point for more than a year. And I had confessed, and I knew I did it. I mean, I confessed as soon as they put handcuffs on me. But what struck me was that so many of my family members, We were looking for a reason to make it okay that I robbed this man. And the thing that made the most sense was to blame my father. But what really was going on, I felt like, was that the court, society, everybody wanted to put the guilt on my mom. And I wanted to stand up and sort of own some of my own failure. And in owning that, you know, I had to tell everybody. I don't really know why it happened, but I know why it didn't happen. And I'm kind of I'm not proud of that much stuff that I've done, but I'm pretty proud of that, especially because I was a young kid and I did it off the cuff.
You're right. I could barely articulate my regret. I couldn't explain how a confluence of bad decisions and opportunity led me to become the caricature of a black boy in America.
And I think that's an important point, too. I think that it is a caricature. This is not the reality of a black boy in America. And yeah, we are over-incarcerated. But, you know, the reality is there's more white people in prison than black. And we have created a narrative that suggests that the prison problem is a black problem. And we continue to create narratives and reinforce narratives around the violence of black boys. And it's a tragedy that sometimes, you know, people embody that caricature. And they embody it unwittingly. You know, they embody it. It's not like I went out and I said, listen, I want to ruin my life and my mother's life and everybody I know's life, like, in 30 seconds. It's not like me and my friends got together and just said, look, let's just do this. You know, my co-defendant, Marcus Bullock, we got locked up. He was 15. I was 16. We got out he got out 7.5 years later. I got out 8.5 years later. I've been married for 11 years. I think he's been married for about 10 years. When he got married, I was his best man. When I got married, he was my best man. He's my oldest son's godfather. I'm his oldest child's godfather. Like, when we were 15 and 16 and he's been a successful businessman, he has a successful TED Talk, he's like presented at the White House, he's done amazing things. But the thing is, when we were 15 and 16 and we did this horrendous thing, it's not just that people wanted to judge us and punish us for this thing that we've done. It's that people wanted to judge us and punish us and decide that we could never, ever do anything different. And so my problem isn't necessarily with the former decision. Mm-hmm. My problem is with the latter. You know, I remember my judge telling me, not my judge, because my judge is Ted McKee.
Here in Philadelphia, we should say. Probably just down the street from us here. Yeah. But yes, Ted McKee.
The judge that sentenced me, I remember he told me, I am under no illusion that sending you to prison will help you. And then he sent me to prison. You know, and that's the thing that troubles me, really, is we don't imagine what will help and we don't imagine what people may become later.
Well, and it should be said, you'd never been in trouble with the law before. You were an honor student. You made, as I think you have said before, a really, really dumb mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's true, but I don't want to suggest that I was, like, innocent. You know, I know a lot of people who have made a series of dumb mistakes. And the real question is, what does intervention look like? And at what point do we decide to abandon people? And right now we have a system that decides to abandon people way, way, way too early. You know, because a lot of times people would tell me that I shouldn't have gone to prison. And they point to the fact that I was intelligent. They point to the fact that I was an honor student. They point to the fact that I'd never held a gun before. But I think there's a lot of men that I was in prison with, a lot of boys that I was in prison with, who deserved another chance, even though they already had five. I went to school with people who had countless opportunities. I went to school with people who grew up and didn't even need to have the chances that we had because they had tutors. Yeah. They had money. They had resources. They had opportunities. They didn't know people who had been murdered as teenagers. And so I think I wish I would have got a second chance, but I don't want to suggest that it was just because I'd never done those things before.
No, I hear you. I mean, I think we all know about the violence of prison, but we know less about what you also write about is the kind of the intimacy, the closeness, the friendship. You were in solitary confinement, and there was a way that people in solitary could share books with each other because there was nothing to do. And, you know, someone slipped this book of poetry of black poets under your door, and you don't know who it is.
I don't.
But it was an act of unbelievable generosity and kindness.
And what's really cool about it is that, like, in America, they lock up so many people. that right now you might have 1,000 dudes saying, look, man, I gave Shahid that book. I'm telling you, I'm the one who did it. But just to tell the story real quickly, I was in solitary confinement and the cells were parallel and you couldn't have books in a hole. But there was sort of like an underground network where men kept books and hid books and had a sort of underground library going on. And all you had to do was shout on the door, somebody send me a book.
Huh.
And a book was
as simple as that.
And the book was sliding under your cell like magic. And nobody even told you the rules. You just knew. You got the book, you read it, and then you passed it to somebody else. You knew you didn't hoard the book. You knew that it was a community library that the guards knew about. And they let it roll because even the guards recognized that it's a certain kind of absurdity in locking a man in a cell for 24 hours a day saying that you can have nothing but the heat that comes in oppressively during the summer and a cold that weighs your bones down during the winter. That's what you get. And so it was COs who just recognized it. And sometimes they would pass the books. But the black poets slipped under my cell. I have no clue who gave it to me. I never asked because you don't ask things like that.
Right.
And I read the book, and the poems changed my life, and it made me a poet.
Changed your life? Had you been introduced to poetry, or was there something about poets?
I mean, I read poetry in school, but they don't take it seriously. They don't do a good job of teaching poetry in school. And so I had already decided to be a writer, but I didn't know what kind of writer I wanted to be. And I read Etheridge Knight in that book, and it was Etheridge Knight who had served time in prison. And he just, like, sort of became this model. I was like, if he did it, you know, I could do it. And then the other poets, Lucille Clifton, Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, Robert Hayden, you know, these poets, Sterling Brown, these poets made me think, oh, this is how, like, to be in the world. This is a medium that the whole sole purpose is to help me understand who I am in this mess, you know, who I am in this cauldron of frustration and pain.
And that's Reginald Dwayne Betts, our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book of poems, and it's called Felon. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'd love to have you read Losing Her. And there's so many beautiful poems in this book, but I kept going back to this one.
Yeah.
I felt like there are two lives here behind this poem that I was just so curious about.
Losing Her. When I was sweating and telling that woman, my bad, sorry, please don't go, I drunk a world of whiskey. I couldn't sing if I wanted. God was throwing dice against my skull. I had lied to her for more days than Jesus spent in the wilderness. They say he was in the desert, but I know the wilderness is worse. Ain't no mirages in the wild. And with whiskey flowing like gospel in my veins, I could hear her sit a shotgun by the door I once carried her through singing real love. Before I started banging on the door, I called her house phone, dialed numbers from a decade before things went digital. I've been loving her so long. But she ain't answer. That number from back when our love was three-way phone calls and laughter and hands that didn't treat her body like a threat. Back then, she loved me in a way she don't now. And so I banged on that door as if I was the police and started weeping and my body slumped, trying but failing to call her name.
That poem just breaks my heart.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah. As you said, the poems are sort of drawn from people that you know but your own life but the emotions there are so palpable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's like, you know, I remember once I was in prison and I had a friend and he was telling me that he had beat up his girlfriend. And like the narrative you get on domestic violence, which is true, is about how brutal it is. But you rarely hear or talk to somebody who's just like devastated by this thing they've done. And it's not to excuse it. It's just to say that, I know a lot of people who thought they could never become something different.
Yeah.
And the poem is sort of contemplating that, but the poem is also trying to acknowledge that sometimes you go too far and the shotgun gets set by the door because you are a threat and you have made it clear that you're the kind of threat that has changed everything that happened yesterday. And it's tragic because, you know, in that moment, in the moment of the poem, you see that, like, self-reflection don't always mean that you get to make things okay. And I think that's kind of like the lesson that we don't get enough from prison. You know, prison makes you think that the only thing that's required is punishment. But the truth is, it's a kind of self-reflection that some of us deal with, and we need to have a conversation about the ways in which you could learn that you
screwed up.
You can learn that you screwed up, which is, you know what? It's actually apropos because I actually screwed up right there.
You did.
after working so hard to change words in this book.
Well, and I should say to our listeners, because I generally hate to do this with poets, but there are some curse words in our guest poetry. And we went through and we took out the ones that, you know, would get us in trouble on Radio Times. But, you know, we're talking. So yeah, the world didn't end.
Yeah, but you realize that sometimes I think the biggest lesson I had, and people say, have you ever talked to your victim? And I say no, because I don't feel like it's my right or will to impose that kind of conversation on him. Reflecting about what happened lets me know that I made a horrible mistake. A mistake that prevents me from ever being a person that could kind of initiate us going back to what we were when we were just strangers.
Yeah.
And that's life. And it's even worse when you hurt somebody you love, but a lot of us hurt people we love. And I would much rather create a system that forces us to grapple with that and think about that than to just imagine that punishment is enough. Because punishment alone very rarely encourages self-reflection. You know, it encourages depression, insanity, time disappearing.
Sure. I want to pick up on that after this short break. Again, Reginald Dwayne Betts is our guest. He's got a new book of poems. It's called Felon. He's spent about 9 years in prison for a crime he committed as a teenager. He's also a lawyer. We have much more to talk about after this short break, including a few more poems. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Reginald Dwayne Betts. He's a poet. He's a lawyer. Two professions he came to through a rather unusual route, prison. He was incarcerated in an adult prison for a crime he committed when 16 years old. Something, though, surprising happened there. He discovered the power of poetry while in solitary confinement. He has since graduated from Yale Law School, now focuses on how mass incarceration affects society as a spokesman for the Campaign for Juvenile Justice. He wrote a memoir a couple years ago. He's got a new book of poetry, and it is titled Felon. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to have you read Blood History, but first, how not to curse in front of people. A lesson from you, our guest.
So I was in prison, right, and I cursed a lot, man. And these guys would tell me, they would say, Shahid, you curse all of the time. And I was like, no, I don't. And then I would start cursing. And they was like, see, that's exactly what I mean. You can't have a conversation. You can't even go a single day without cursing. And I said, look, I could not curse. I could never curse. And they said, all right, well, how about this? You give me 25 push-ups for every curse word. And so what happened was somebody would stand behind me as I was talking to somebody else. And then after I finished, they would say, all right, that's 200 push-ups. And the next day, you know, it'd be 300 push-ups. And some days, now I worked out religiously in prison. So we would have a full, you know, 2-3 hour workout, and then I would have to do 400 push-ups at night before I could, like, take a shower and get ready to, like, kick back, right? And so after doing thousands and thousands and thousands of push-ups, I just learned to like, ruthlessly control the words that came out of my mouth. And so sometimes I talk to kids and I'll curse a lot, and then I'll spend the next 40 minutes talking to them, not cursing.
Not doing push-ups?
Yeah. It just teaches them that, you know, like you could train yourself to control your tongue, you know.
Did you miss them, though, those words?
I still use them. I had more control over them. And it might have been better for me as a poet to recognize the significance of language and to recognize that, you know, as a writer, you want to control the thing you say. I mean, one of the poems that I changed for this show, I think I made better. You know, I really like what I did to change it, because the word prison repeats so much already. That changing it to circling these cells is a different image and is, like, evocative in a different type of way. And so, yeah, you know, you never know.
Did poetry then, I always hate this word, rehabilitate you?
I was 16, man. What 16-year-old needs to be rehabilitated, really? You know, and I think that's one of the things about going to prison so young is that I had to get grown. And getting grown changed me. Getting grown rehabilitated me. And maybe if anything, poetry gave me a vision. It makes me look at the world in a different way, you know, like a poet's eye. But I wouldn't say prison rehabilitated me. I was a kid. I was so young.
What's a poet's eye to you?
The best way to describe it is that if I showed you my cell phone right now, you would see 6 or 7 four-leaf clovers on the back. If I open up my wallet, you would see 3, 4. If you came in my house and just went through my books, you would just randomly find four-leaf clovers dropping out. Hmm. And it's not that I'm particularly gifted or special or that four-leaf clovers like me. It's just that I got an aunt named Violet who taught me how to find four-leaf clovers.
Literally how to find four-leaf clovers?
Yeah, but in the teaching, all she taught me was to be patient and to look. And I think what it means to have a poet's vision is just to be patient and to look. And frequently you're looking at things that other folks don't care to see.
Uh-huh. In that New York Times essay, I keep referring to it, but there was so much in there. You talk about how prison taught you to wait. Yeah. Is that also about looking? That by waiting, you end up looking?
Yeah, you learn to respect time in such a different way. You know, like you always waiting. You're waiting for count time. You're waiting for child call. You're waiting for a visit. You're waiting for the mailman to come. But the thing you're mostly waiting on is to take, like freedom. And so, you know, and having to wait so much, if you can't get some type of joy out of waiting, if you can't get some type of pleasure out of waiting, then the waiting will drive you crazy.
Yeah. I'd love to have you read another poem. This one is called Blood History.
Blood History. The things that abandon you get remembered different, as precise as the English language can be, with words like penultimate and perseverate. There is not a combination of sounds that describe only that leaving. Once, drinking and smoking with buddies, a friend asked if I longed for a father. Had he said wanted, I would have dismissed him in a way that youngins dismiss it all. A shrug, sarcasm, a jab to his stomach, laughter. But he said longing. And in a different place, I might have wept. Said once, my father lived with us, and then he didn't, and it hurt me so much I never thought about his leaving until I held my own son in my arms, and only now speak on it. A man who drank Boone's Farm and Mad Dog like water once told me and some friends that there is no word for father where he comes from, not like we know it. There, the word father is the same as the word for listen. The blunts we passed around let us forget our tongues. Not that much, though. But what if the old head knew something? And if you have no father, you can't hear straight. Years later, another friend wondered why I named my son after my father. You know, that's a thing, turn your life to a prayer that no dead man gonna answer.
And again, that's our guest, a poet, also lawyer, Reginald Dwayne Betts, and another poem from his new collection of poetry, Felon, and it's called Blood History. Again, there is so much in here. This word longing is different from the word wanting? Wanting.
Yeah.
I had longed for a father. Had he said wanted, I would have dismissed him in a way that youngins dismiss it all, a shrug, sarcasm, a jab to his stomach, laughter. But he said longing, and in a different place, I might have wept. Because longing is just that, the deepness of that feeling.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, wanting seems, like when you're a kid, you know, you just want that. You don't need it. But longing is beyond want or need. You know, longing acknowledges that this thing is like visceral. It exists in a place beyond, you know, whatever name we might give to it that refers to, like, the necessity of it. Longing is something that's this past necessity. And, sometimes, and I think, you know, when you actually think about the things you long for, that's when you're in trouble, because that's when you got to confront the real hurt of all of it.
And your dad is also Reginald Dwayne Betts, right?
Yeah. But I didn't long for my dad.
You didn't long for your dad?
Nah, I didn't.
Why is that?
I was young. Everybody called me Dwayne. I think my dad is cool now. I really appreciate the relationship that I have with him. But I do know people who long for their father. And in writing that, and I didn't name my sons after my father either. But in writing that, I was thinking about, like, honestly, I was thinking about how I would long for my children if I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how, like, what it means to have the kind of relationship with your child that makes longing possible. You know, I didn't have the kind of relationship with my dad that makes longing possible. I think that if I pretended like that's the kind of feeling I felt for his absence, I would be lying. In fact, maybe what I do, and, you know, I'm Reginald Dwayne Betts Jr. or the second or something, but mm-hmm. everybody calls me Dwayne or Shahid. And when I publish under Reginald Dwayne Betts. And part of that is because I want to create a connection and a bond with my dad that I didn't necessarily have when I was younger. But it's more about regret than longing. Mm-hmm. And the regret is not just for his absence, but, you know, my dad came up in the 80s. He came up during the war on drugs. He came up in D.C. when, you know, 300, 400 people were getting murdered a year, when crack, when, like, you went to school with people and they literally, you know, like, literally became vacant. They literally got addicted to drugs in such a way that it profoundly changed how you thought about the world. Like, you know, and nobody cared. It wasn't the opioid crisis where it was a national health epidemic and people cared. This was, it's a line by Pusha T where he says a toothless crackhead was the mascot. You know, this was like a era where, like, nobody cared about the suffering the folks were dealt with. And so, you know, I think about my dad in the sense of he could have been so many different things that he wasn't because of the time period that he was born. Like Baldwin said, you are who you are because you were born black this year in Harlem. And he's talking about
time
his nephew.
Time and place, right?
Yeah, so I think about my dad in that way. And I mean, that's why I named the book after him. So well, that's why I name my books that I publish. I leave it as my name and his name so that he gets some publishing credits. You know, whatever.
What's that like for him, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, when I ask myself what's it like for him, I end up thinking about really what's it like for my mom. Because again, you know, in my complicated relationship with my dad and in my complicated relationship with, like, prison, I've, like, damaged the relationship I had with my mom. You know, we missed those 8 years. And so I riff on the thing I just said about my dad. But then when I leave here, I'm going to let it go and I'm going to call my mom. You know, it's like, so I don't know what it's like for him. And I don't know. I mean, and it's not that I don't care. It's just that, like, your heart really could only hold so much, you know. So intellectually and when I give myself moments to really reflect on it or write poetry about it, it's the kind of hurt that's there. But it's something that's, like, deeper when I think about my mom, maybe in the years that we lost. Yeah. And that's why there's no poems about my mom.
Well, you do have a poem called Confession, and I'd love to have you read that as well.
Confession. If I told her how often I thought of prison, she would walk out of the door that's led just as much to madness as any home we desired. She would walk out and never return. My employers would call me a liar and fire me. My dreams are not all nightmares, but this history has turned my mind's landscape into a gadroon. I do not sing, have lied for so many months now that truth harbingers loss. Sleeping beside her when a memory is holding me tight as she did before the lies turned everything into a battle. I once gasped and lurched and tried to strangle the pillow she placed beneath my head, imagining me explaining that to her while still shivering like a panicked and broken man. I stopped believing in God long before then, but that night when outside there was no light but darkness, I swore something of what inevitable is touched me. My children slept with their light on. I walked to their still lit room. My son was asleep and his brother draped over his body as if he were the pillow. The way he loved his brother was everything my time in the cell denied me. If I told my woman that, she would want to know if I thought I deserved all that lost. Her mother wonders why I won't let it go and hold on to the happiness in this life we have. But how do I explain that outside on nights like this is where I first learned just how violent I might be? That I think of prison because in all these years, I still can't pronounce the name of my victim.
And again, another poem titled Confession. And again, just such a powerful story. And there's so much there with the children in bed, yeah. The pillow, you know, the young child is a pillow over his brother.
Yeah.
That this feels real to me.
Well, you know, all lies are truth.
Everything. All lies are truth.
You know, I mean, it's like one of those weird things where I think maybe this is the first book I've wrote where when I read from it, it's like it's something that pauses inside my chest a little bit.
Because mm-hmm. It is so personal.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's personal in a way that, like, Justice Sotomayor once said something that upset me a lot. She said that I appreciated and that upset me. She said, I call them undocumented immigrants because it's not like they're criminals. I mean, they're not criminals. She was like, they're just people with a problem. You know, they like my cousins. They like my uncles. They like the people that grew up with me, the people in my neighborhood. And the part about that that I loved is that how she named those people kin. The part I disliked was that she needed to distinguish them from criminals. Because they could be criminals and still be like cousins. And in this book, I think I'm writing about people who, and I'm writing about myself, and I'm recognizing that like we are cousins, we family members, we friends, we people who are more, like always more than just criminals.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We haven't talked about the law part of your life, but you did write something. Poetry and law have always been intertwined in my mind. And I think of law briefs as, you know, the most sort of boring, inscrutable things written.
So does everybody.
And so does everyone else. And poetry is almost like the opposite of that. I mean, good poetry.
Yeah. I'm trying to be a legend in two sports, like I'm Pee Wee Kirkland. It's like seven people that's going to know where that came from, and I'm so excited that I got to say that line.
There you go.
In these poems, I wrote these redacted poems, actually. And in fact, I was like, let me take like something that's inscrutable, something that's nearly incomprehensible. But it is actually like the very basis of society saying, listen, you have a forum where you could express discontent. And in that forum, you could express discontent with the state, with the city, with the locality. You could say that judges are locking us up for our inability to pay fines, to pay bail, to pay fees, and it is wrong. And you could go in front of another judge and say, do something about this. And so that's what those lawsuits are. But what does it mean if that has to be 70 pages that's inscrutable to any regular person? And I was like, well, that's not okay. So let me redact what's superfluous. Let me redact what is obscuring what's at the heart of these situations. And let me leave you with what really matters. And that's how I created those redaction poems. And that's how I tried to make the literal law and poetry become one.
Yeah, interesting. And I won't do justice to it. In Missouri, city of Ferguson, the plaintiffs, redacted people, redacted, jailed by the city, redacted, the city kept a human, redacted, in its jail, the person, and you go on from there. Well, we have to end our conversation, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was such a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Reginald Dwayne Betts, our guest. And again, he's got a new collection of poems, and it's called Felon. He also wrote a memoir a couple of years ago called A Question of Freedom, a memoir of learning, survival, and coming of age in prison. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And we're going to post some photos on our Facebook page as well. And I think our guest is going to read a poem, which we will post there as well. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.